And our last word in business technology today is a happy anniversary wish to a tiny government agency that you may never have heard of, but if you use the internet, it affects you. The Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency turns 50 this week. It's known as DARPA. The agency was set up after the Soviet Union beat the U.S. into space with Sputnik, the satellite. DARPA's mission was to prevent technological surprise. The agency funds what are considered high-risk ideas, and it's most famous for creating the blueprint for what we now know as the Internet. Among its current projects, the Washington Post reports, is a speech translation system that would, in theory, allow soldiers to go anywhere in the world and use a headset to understand any people around them. And that's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
Now that we know how an iPod's shuffle function works, and you took notes, right? We offer a bit of insight into the power of iPod marketing. A new study indicates that the logo on Apple products like iPods, iPhones, iMacs stimulates your brain. The study found that people who were shown the Apple logo scored higher on a creativity test than those who were exposed to the IBM logo, presumably because they were mirroring the traits they associate with those logos. Professor Gavin Fitzsimmons of the Fuqua School of Business at Duke University co-wrote the study on logos and the brain. He joins us now from Durham, North Carolina. So, Professor, tell us, what exactly were the traits that people associated with Apple and with IBM?
People find that when they think about the Apple logo, they think very strongly about associations with creativity. When they think about the IBM logo, they think about the general notion of competence or professional.
So the people you studied actually took on traits that they associated with these brands? I mean, the Apple creative ones began humming new compositions and the IBM ones got organized and competent?
Essentially, yes. We showed people on the computer for very, very short durations, like 30 milliseconds, either the Apple logo or the IBM logo. And then we looked at their behavior to see if, as you say, they hummed compositions or not. The Apple Prime people were much more creative than the IBM Prime people by like 20 to 30%.
This is a tremendous advertisement for Apple. Are they involved in this project at all, like funding it?
No, not surprisingly, many people ask me that question.
Yes.
But no, to ensure sort of the integrity of the project, we've never actually even spoken to anyone at any of the companies whose logos we use.
Huh. What do you think the message is for consumers, Professor?
We're obviously being influenced by the things around us. And so we should be somewhat wary of what's around us. And then we should be strategically surrounding ourselves with logos that have associations that we find to be desirable.
Hmm. And what's the implication for advertisers then?
If every time you see an Apple logo, you find yourself being more creative, you're going to be a little happier in all likelihood.
Uh-huh.
And all of a sudden, I think at a non-conscious level, we as consumers will start to pair the brand that we're being exposed to with this increased happiness. And that should, you know, result in some increase in loyalty from their customers, I would imagine, over time.
Thanks very much. Gavin Fitzsimmons is a professor at the Fuqua School of Business at Duke University. His study of the impact of logos appears in the April issue of the Journal of Consumer Research. Thanks.
Thank you, Susan.
This is NPR News. Lisa Forrest, a listener from Bethesda, Maryland, has a math question perhaps as vexing as the ultimate value of pi or the solution to Fermat's last theorem. What, she asks, are the mathematics behind the random feature of iPods? It's also known as the shuffle mode, the idea being that your iPod will pick out songs at random and play them for you. Ms. Forrest wonders why the same songs keep coming up while so many others never get played. So who else would we turn to for iPod algorithms but our own math guy, Keith Devlin? Hi, Keith.
Hi, Susan. Nice to talk to you again.
I agree. Nice to talk to you. So tell us, why is the shuffle meant to be random, or does it just sit there and shuffle?
It is indeed meant to be random. And before we get on to the math part of this, I think I should mention that if you go into iTunes and look at the various settings for iTunes, you will find that it's possible to set the degree to which the random shuffle operates. You can set it to shuffle without repetitions, or you can set it to shuffle where it plays your favourite songs more frequently. So you actually have quite a choice of the degree of randomization. So Lisa's problem may be that she's using a setting which deliberately selects certain songs over and over again. But then there's the mathematical part, and this is, of course, the part that you've really got me on to talk about. People have an enormous difficulty recognising randomness, because one of the features of a genuinely random selection is you get lots of repetitions. What people usually think of as random is what we call Humanly distributed. But in fact, randomness is full of patterns. For example, if you start tossing a coin, you're going to get heads and tails and heads and tails. If you tossed it maybe 20 times, you're very likely to get three heads in a row or three tails. You're going to get streaks. An even more dramatic one was in the news about a week ago. Some mathematicians simulated all of the Major League Baseball games that have ever been played, assuming that the outcome of every pitch was random. And do you know, if every pitch had been random, you would get all of the records and streaks that baseball has ever seen, including Joe DiMaggio's famed 56-game hitting streak.
No.
In other words, all of the records of in baseball could equally well have arisen by pure random behaviour. So Joe DiMaggio might just have been the guy who was lucky enough to get that 56 streak, which was going to come up sooner or later, because randomness produces patterns and streaks that usually surprise us.
Well, who would have thought of that?
So assuming that Apple have designed a really good randomizer in the iPod, then you are going to start getting repeats of songs, and you are going to find that some songs don't come up seemingly for a long time. That's the way random behavior is.
Keith, by the way, do you ever use random or shuffle on your iPod?
Actually, I very rarely use random. I tend to like, I'm a mathematician, I like to know what's coming next. So I run mine through sequentially. I start with my favourite song and I go through them to the least favourite. I've got hundreds of them ordered by favourites within different playlists.
And what are you listening to right now?
Well, right now I'm listening to you, Susan, but on my iPod.
You're lucky I don't sing.
I'm too old to multitask to that extent, I'm afraid. But right now I've got a song by a group from Austin, Texas called Wide Awake. And it's called Maybe Tonight, Maybe Tomorrow.
So that's your favourite, and what's your least favourite? What's at the bottom of your list?
Well, it's on my list, so I like it. But right at the bottom of my list is Danny Boy, sung by three Irish tenors whose names I don't forget.
I totally approve of that choice.
And that just reminds me of my ancestors hundreds of years ago from Ireland. I wasn't born in Ireland, but I think I have Irish ancestry.
I would put it right down there with klezmer music in my own iPod if I owned one. It's time for us to shuffle off. Thank you very much, Keith Devlin, Executive Director for the Center for the Study of Language and Information at Stanford.
Okay, thanks, Susan, and good luck to you.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Kids these days, huh? Young people and adults seem to have very different views when it comes to privacy and the Internet. If you're a parent, you may be worried that your kids are all too willing to share personal information. Well, recently, Facebook announced new privacy settings. They help users control who can read what on a Facebook page. We're going to take a look at how young people are thinking about privacy and the public nature of sites such as Facebook. First, as NPR's Laura Seidel reports, kids may be more sophisticated than their parents realize.
Linda and Kevin Comboy and their three children, Maddie, Lily, and Cullen, live in a big old house with worn wood floors in Berkeley, California. Lily is a pretty confident 15-year-old, but when she was in middle school, a whole group of her friends decided they didn't like her anymore. So they took her name off their MySpace friends list. She was defriended.
It's like writing it out in like bold letters that we're not friends anymore, and like now we're really close. But I just think that that's like a little bit brutal to like not be friends with someone on MySpace.
There were some mean things put up, not necessarily about you, but about each other. And I think it's normal things that kids are trying to work out. But it becomes this public forum, and kids can really feel hurt. In fact, we used to call it mean space.
It isn't just MySpace where kids can be cruel. Lily says she doesn't like Facebook's honesty box, where you write anonymous notes.
Because my friends get like the meanest comments, like things about like those shorts that you wear are like way too short and like you can see your cellulite or something.
Lily has decided that she doesn't want to sign up for the Honesty Box. It's one of many decisions about what to put online that she and other young people face every day as social networking sites devise a maze of privacy settings and applications. Sometimes the struggles over what goes online are between peers. Lily's 17-year-old sister Maddie once had a fight with a friend over what to put on her website.
She took a picture of my butt with a pair of very lacy underwear on and wanted to put it on my MySpace, but I kind of told her I didn't want it up there.
Did she have your password so she could put stuff up?
Maddie's friend did have her password, but fortunately she talked her friend out of posting the picture.
That was probably the most personal almost experience I had on there, just because she was very like, it's a good picture, it looks so good. And it was the kind of thing that if she had a picture like that, she would have probably put up.
Mom Linda is amazed at how much her kids have actually thought about privacy. Linda, who's in her 40s, thinks they're more sophisticated than she was.
They just seem more knowledgeable, and I just don't think privacy was an issue. I don't remember even being aware of it, I guess. What about you, Kev?
Well, you know, I think one thing is the whole judgment thing, and when we were kids, if you said something mean to a kid in a lunchroom, you could clean it up relatively quickly. Now, somebody takes a picture of somebody on a cell phone, puts it on a MySpace page, and that's out there forever.
But Kevin Conboy's high school-age daughters are using some discretion, and they may be passing through a phase on their way to having even more discretion. Let's step out of the Conboy's living room and visit with young adults who've moved out of the house. Here at San Francisco State University, students are having lunch at the Student Union. Privacy settings are very popular. These settings allow 20-year-old Andrea Miracle to block the general public from seeing her MySpace page.
Like, my MySpace page is private. So, like, only people who are my friends can see my page.
And how does somebody qualify as your friend? Do you have to know them to let them in?
Well, yeah.
Facebook says every time it adds more privacy settings, more people take advantage of them. 25-year-old Jana Roberts is a student originally from Kazakhstan, and she says these settings are essential.
I eliminate everyone and only accept my friends. That's the first what I always do. And if they don't have this kind of, like, you know, policy, I just don't register there.
18-year-old Emilia Villanueva admits he was once a little more naive about what he put online.
I guess when I was younger, I used to put like more inappropriate stuff on it, but then it just like it makes you look like an idiot after a while. So then I sort of like keep it like low key now.
All these students realize what they put up when they were younger could come back to haunt them when they go looking for a job. And they do think about it when they decide what to put online. Still, they may make different choices than their parents would. But they are very deliberate choices that reflect the values of their generation. 30-year-old Shana Naomi Crockmall, the editor of Out.com, has had some embarrassing moments.
I certainly, in the last 5 years, have had a number of experiences that were a little, they weren't uncomfortable. They were like mildly awkward, where I walked into a new job and I realized every single person at my welcome lunch had Googled me and had read, you know, kind of intense personal essays that I had written for publication years before.
But Crockmall wasn't that bothered by her experience. She thinks it's common for her generation, and it may be a new rite of passage, one that can toughen you up.
I think what we're seeing is a generation of kids who grow up who know that people are talking about them. Maybe they want people to talk about them, but either way, I think they're a little bit more in touch with the basic reality of how people and gossip and communication actually works.
As more and more of the internet generation gets out in the workforce, there may be safety in numbers, says Clay Shirky, author of Here Comes Everybody, a book about social media.
Where employers say, you know what, if I'm going to only interview people that I can't find anything embarrassing about, my application pool is going to shrink by 40%.
Keeping kids from putting personal stuff online is probably a lost cause. Still, Crockmall of Out.com thinks it's important for parents to talk to their kids.
I feel like it's another version of the same birds and the bees talk. And I think that's a good field for parental advice. I don't think it's necessarily going to help to tell a 15-year-old you should never have sex any more than I think it's going to help a 15-year-old to say you should never put your picture on the internet.
At least some parents are going to have discomfort with whatever their kids put up on the internet. But perhaps they can take heart in the fact that young people are thinking hard about the implications of what they do and making deliberate choices about what they put online. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
We're going to focus now on what kids in high school and middle school are doing online these days. And with us is Mary Madden, senior researcher with the Pew Internet and American Life Project. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
And first of all, you study online usage by teens and younger children. What can you tell us about how much time they typically spend online and what the trends are?
Well, over time, we've seen that more and more teenagers are online. And so at this point, 93% of teens ages 12 to 17 use the internet. And that's up from just 73% in 2000 when we did our first study. Over time, the frequency and intensity of their internet usage is also increasing, such that most teens are using the internet every single day.
We heard in Laura's story that whenever places like Facebook or MySpace offer privacy settings, people jump at them and use them. Do you think that's true, that kids really appreciate the privacy, or is the whole idea that you should put something out that everybody from Albuquerque to Zambia should be able to see?
Well, I think this space is full of a lot of contradictions because on the one hand, we see that teenagers who use social networking sites are actually quite savvy about their privacy and restricting access to friends only, for instance. So 55% of online teens maintain a profile on a social networking site, and most of them restrict access to it in some way. However, it depends on how many people you have as friends. If you have a network of 300 friends, all of a sudden that private network starts to become very public.
Now, as far as parents whose kids might be using these sites, I know you're not, you know, Pew isn't in the business of giving guidance, but personally, what did you think about the statement, "I really can't tell my kid not to put her picture out on Facebook"?
I think that's a smart assessment. I think that a lot of this relates to the concept of self-literacy online. And so this is the idea that we need to be aware of the various digital footprints that we leave online. And so one basic thing that parents can do is sit down with their child and simply Google their name. Mm-hmm. They can also share experiences perhaps that they've had about information that has persisted online about them and how they've dealt with that. Also, even though this technology has presented a lot of challenges for parents, it has presented a lot of resources for them. So you have sites like GetNetWise or NetSmarts, ConnectSafely.org. These are all great resources for parents in finding advice and tips to help stay connected with their kids and keep them safe.
But it seems like would parents find on those sites some, let's say, appropriate object lessons for kids of different ages? Was trying to tell an 8-year-old that when you're applying for a job, somebody is going to see that, or in your college application, someone will Google you and see the picture that you shot when you were doing whatever. That doesn't sound like it would make a lot of sense to a very young child.
That's right. And younger children are more likely to be interested at that point in games. Games are one of the first point of entry for young teenagers. And what we see in our research is that parents are doing things like putting the computers in a public place in the home, for instance. That's one of the most basic things that's recommended by those that promote online safety. Also doing things like monitoring your children's internet use, whether that's through the use of a filter or simply being in the same room while they're on the computer. I also think simply talking to your children, being involved, perhaps even creating a profile and friending your child on these social networks. But you need to realize
your children will really appreciate
that. Yeah, that it might creep them out, and that they can create a fake profile, of course, to friend you, and they can have another profile that they use to interact with their friends. So that's something to be aware of and something to talk about.
Do you think, by the way, do you just get the sense that kids who are growing up doing all these things are going to be adults who will just have very different values about what is literally their space and what is public space where information about them is just shared widely?
I do think that as a society, especially as these teenagers move into college and into the workplace, we will need to become more forgiving of some of these sort of information indiscretions. I think many people will find that over time, with the persistence of information online, there will be more and more sort of personal data leftovers gone bad. And we'll understand, I think, that you can't really control some of this and that certain choices made in one's life when you're a teenager shouldn't necessarily be held up to sort of judge your willingness or ability to perform a job at, you know, age 35, for instance. So I think over time we'll come to think about things a bit differently.
You assume that when today's 10-year-olds are 35, the 50-year-olds doing the hiring at that point would also have experienced a great deal of this, perhaps.
Absolutely. And we're seeing even among adults that a fairly small number have done a simple act of plugging their name into a search engine. Only 47% of online adults have Googled their name online right now. And I think we're going to see that number increase over time as people realize I need to at least be as aware as other people are of what information is out there about me.
Mary Madden, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Robert.
Mary Madden is senior researcher with the Pew Internet and American Life Project.
And demand for blackberries is booming. The company that makes the BlackBerry, Research in Motion, says it gained more than 2 million new customers in the most recent quarter. NPR's Wendy Kaufman has more.
Research in Motion turned in a strong performance this fiscal year, capped by a better-than-expected fourth quarter. The company's quarterly revenue, $1.88 billion, and its profit were both up more than 100% over the same period last year. Jim Balsley, co-CEO of the company, spoke to reporters and analysts in a conference call late yesterday.
It's been an exciting year at RIM with the introduction of a record number of new devices, numerous new software introductions, and a strong focus on expanding our distribution channels.
Research in Motion now has more than 14 million subscribers. About two-thirds of all BlackBerry users are business clients. But Research in Motion has been offering models that provide video, cameras, and music to move beyond its base and into direct competition with Apple's iPhone. And speaking of the iPhone, there are reports that some Apple retail stores are out of stock, leading to speculation that a new version of the iPhone will be released sooner than originally expected. Apple is mum on the subject. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.